Rimming.
As a child, my stutter had come and gone mysteriously, just like this. But it had been with me for so long now, I'd thought it permanent. I talked on and on. I spoke quietly about the evils of slavery that I'd seen with my own eyes. I told them about Handful and her mother and her sister. I spared them nothing. Finally, I peered over my glasses and took them in for a moment. "We won't be silent any more. We women will declare ourselves for the slave, and we won't be silent until they're free." I turned then and walked back to my chair while the women rose and filled the hall with their applause. We spoke before large gatherings in New York City for weeks before holding a campaign in New Jersey, and then traveling on to towns along the Hudson. The women came in throngs, proliferating like the loaves and fishes in the Bible. In a church in Poughkeepsie, the crowd was so great the balcony cracked and the church had to be evacuated, forcing us to deliver our speeches outside in the frost and gloom of February. And not one woman left. In every town we visited, we encouraged the women to form their own anti-slavery societies, and we set them collecting signatures on petitions. My stutter came and went, though it kindly stayed away for most of my speeches. We became modestly famous and extravagantly infamous. Throughout that winter and spring, news of our exploits was carried by practically every newspaper in the country. The anti-slavery papers published our speeches, and tens of thousands of our pamphlets were in print. Even our former president, John Quincy Adams, agreed to meet with us, promising he would deliver the petitions the women were collecting to Congress. In a few cities in the South, we were hung in effigy right along with Mr. Garrison, and our mother had sent word we could no longer set foot in Charleston without fear of imprisonment. Mr. Weld was our lifeline. He wrote us joint letters, praising our efforts. He called us brave and stalwart and dogged. Now and then he added a postscript for Nina alone. "Angelina, it's widely said you keep your audiences in thrall. As director of your training, I wish I could take credit, but it's all you." On a balmy afternoon in April, he appeared without prior notice at Garrett Smith's country house in Peterborough, New York, where Nina and I were spending several days during our latest round of lectures. He'd come, he said, to discuss society finances with Mr. Smith, the organization's largest benefactor, but one could hardly miss the coincidence. Each morning, he and Nina took a walk along the lane that led through the orchards. He'd invited me as well, but I'd taken one look at Nina's face and declined. He accompanied us to our afternoon lectures, waiting outside the halls, and in the evenings, the three of us sat with Mr. and Mrs. Smith in the parlor, as we debated strategies for our cause and recounted our adventures. When Mrs. Smith suggested it was time for the women to say goodnight, Theodore and Nina would glance at one another, reluctant to part, and he would say, "Well then, you must get your rest." And Nina would leave the room with painful slowness. The day he departed, I watched from the window as the two of them returned from their walk. It had started to rain while they were out, one of those sudden downbursts during which the sun goes right on shining, and he was holding his coat over their heads, making a little tent for them. They walked without the least bit of hurry. I could see they were laughing. As they came onto the porch, shaking off the wetness, he bent and kissed my sister's cheek. In June, we arrived in Amesbury, Massachusetts, for a two-week respite at the clapboard cottage of a Mrs. Whittier. We were soon to begin a crusade of lectures in New England that would last through the fall, but we were ragged with fatigue, in need of fresh, more seasonal clothes, and I had an airy little cough I couldn't get rid of. Mrs. Whittier was cherry-cheeked and plump, and fed us rich soups, dosed with cod liver oil, refused all visitors, and forced us to bed before the moon appeared. It was several days before we discovered she was the mother of John Greenleaf Whittier, Theodore's close friend. We were sitting in the parlor, having tea, when she began to speak of her son and his long friendship with Theodore, and we understood now why she'd taken us in. "You must know Theodore well, then," Nina said. "Teddy? Oh, he's like a son to me, and a brother to John." She shook her head. "I suppose you've heard of that awful pledge they made."
"Pledge?" said Nina. "Why, no, we've heard nothing of it."
"Well, I don't approve. I think it's too extreme. A woman my age would like grandchildren, after all. But they're men of principle, those two. There's no reasoning with them."
Nina sat up on the edge of her chair, and I could see the brightness leave her. "What did they pledge?"
"They vowed neither of them would marry until slavery was abolished. Honestly, it will hardly be in their lifetimes."
That night I was awakened by a knock on my door long after the moon set. Nina stood there with her face like a seawall, grim and braced.
"I can't bear it," she said, and fell against my shoulder.
That summer of 1837, New Englanders came by the thousands to hear us speak, and for the first time, men began to appear in the audiences. At first a handful, then 50, then hundreds. That we spoke publicly to women was bad enough. That we spoke publicly to men turned the Puritan world on its head.
"They'll be lighting the pyres," I said to Nina when the men first showed, trying to slough it off. We laughed, but it became not funny at all. "I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence." Was there ever a more galling verse in the Bible? It was preached that summer from every pulpit in New England, with the Grimke sisters in mind. The Congregational churches passed a resolution of censure against us, urging a boycott of our lectures, and in its wake, a number of churches and public halls were closed to us. In Pepperell, we were forced to deliver our message in a barn with the horses and cows.
"As you see, there's no room at the inn," Nina told them. "But still, the wise men have come."
We tried to be brave and stalwart and dogged, as Theodore had described us in his letter, and we began using portions of our lectures to defend our right to speak.
"What we claim for ourselves, we claim for every woman."
That was our rally cry in Lowell and Worcester and Duxbury. Indeed, everywhere we went. You should have seen the women, how they flocked to our side. And some, like the brave ladies of Andover, wrote public letters in our defense. My old friend Lucretia got a message to us all the way from Philadelphia. It contained four words: "Press on, my sisters." Without intending to, we set the country in an uproar. The matter of women having certain rights was new and strange and pilloried, but it was suddenly debated all the way to Ohio. They renamed my sister Devilina. They christened us Female Incendiaries. Somehow, we'd lit the fuse. The last week of August, we returned to Mrs. Whittier's cottage as if from battle. I felt tired and beleaguered, uncertain if I could continue with the fall lectures. The last teaspoon of fight had been scraped out of me. Our final meeting of the summer had ended with dozens of angered men standing on wagons outside the hall shouting, "Devilina!" and hurling rocks as we left. One had hit my mouth, transforming my lower lip into a fat red sausage. I looked a sight. I wasn't sure what Mrs. Whittier would say to all this, if she would even give us shelter. We were pariahs now. But when we arrived, she pulled us into her arms and kissed our foreheads.
On the third day of refuge, I returned from a stroll along the banks of the Merrimack to find Nina canting sharply against the window, as if she'd fallen asleep, her head pressed to the glass, her eyes closed, her arms drooped by her sides. She looked like a spinning top that had come to rest. Hearing my footsteps, she turned and pointed to the tea table where the Boston Morning Post lay open. Mrs. Whittier took care to hide the editorials, but Nina had found the paper in the bread box. August 25. The Mrs. Grimke have made speeches, written pamphlets, and exhibited themselves in public in unwomanly ways for a while now, but they have not found husbands. Why are all the old hens abolitionists? Because not being able to obtain husbands, they think they may stand some chance for a Negro, if they can only make amalgamation fashionable. I couldn't finish it. If that's not enough, Theodore will be arriving this afternoon along with Elijah Wright and Mrs. Whittier's son, John. Their letter came while you were out. Mrs. Whittier is in there making mince pies. She hadn't spoken of Theodore all summer, but she was sick with longing for him. It was plain on her face. The men arrived at 3 o'clock. My lip was almost back to its normal size, and I could speak now without sounding as if my mouth was stuffed with food. But it was still sore, and I remained quiet, waiting for them to come to their purpose, remembering the way Theodore defended us before.
It is supremely ridiculous. They should be bullied from this great moment.
Today he was wearing 2 shades of green that made one wince. He walked to the mantel and picked up a piece of scrimshaw and inspected it. His eyes went to Nina. He said,
"There has not been a contribution to the anti-slavery movement more impressive or tireless than that of the Grimke sisters."
"Hear, hear,"
said dear Mrs. Whittier, but I saw her son lower his eyes, and I knew then why they had come.
"We commend you for it,"
Theodore went on.
"And yet by encouraging men to join your audiences, you've mired us in a controversy that has taken the attention away from abolition. We've come hoping to convince you..."
Nina interrupted him.
"Hoping to convince us to behave like good lapdogs and wait content beneath the table for whatever crumbs you toss to us? Is that what you hope?"
Her rebuke was so swift and scathing I wondered if it was in reaction to his marriage pledge as much as anything.
"Angelina, please, just hear us out," he said. "We're on your side. At heart we are. I, of all people, support your right to speak. It's downright senseless to keep men away from your meetings."
"Then why do you quibble?"
I asked.
"Because we sent you out there on behalf of abolition, not women."
He glanced at John, whose heavy brows and lean face made me feel the two could have been actual brothers, not just figurative ones.
"He only means to say the slave is of greater urgency," John added. "I suppose the cause of women, too, but surely you can't lose sight of the slave because of a selfish crusade against some paltry grievance of your own."
"Paltry!" Nina cried. "Is our right to speak paltry?"
"In comparison to the cause of abolition, yes, I say it is."
Mrs. Whittier drew up in her chair.
"Really, John? As a woman, I didn't think I had a grievance until you began speaking."
"Why must it be one or the other?"
Nina asked.
"Sarah and I haven't ceased to work for abolition. We're speaking for slaves and women both. Don't you see? We could do 100 times more for the slave if we weren't so fettered."
She turned to Theodore, casting on him the most beautiful, imploring look.
"Can't you stand side by side with me? With us?"
He drew a long breath, and his face gave him away. It was twisted with love and distress. But he'd come on a mission, and as Mrs. Whittier had said, He was a man of principle, right or wrong. Angelina, I think of you as my friend, the dearest of friends, and it tortures me to go against you. But now is the time to stand with the slave. The time will come for us to take up the woman question, but not yet. The time to assert one's right is when it's denied. I'm sorry, he told her. Outside, the wind swirled up, churning the leaves in the birch. The sound and smell of it loomed through the open window, and I had a sudden fleeting memory of playing beneath the oak in the workyard back home, forming words with my brother's marbles. Sarah, go. And then the slave woman is dragged from the cowhouse and whipped. I don't scream or make a sound. I say nothing at all. The older Mr. Wright had begun his piece, coming to the crux of it.
It saddens me, but your agitation for women harms our cause. It threatens to split the abolition movement in two. I can't believe you want that. We're only asking you to confine your audiences to women and refrain from further talk about women's reform.
Hushing up the Grimke sisters. Would it never stop? I looked at Mr. Wright, sitting there rubbing his arthritic fingers, and then at John and Theodore. These good men who wish to quash us, gently, of course, benignly, for the good of abolition, for our own good, for their good, for the greater good. It was all so familiar. Theirs was only a different kind of muzzle. I'd spoken but once since they'd gotten here, and it seemed to me now I'd spent my entire life trying to coax back the voice that left me that long-ago day under the tree. Nina, clearly furious, had stopped arguing. She looked at me, beseeching me to say something. I lifted my fingers to my mouth and touched the last bit of swollenness on my lip, feeling the uprush of indignation that had sustained me through the summer, and, I suppose, my whole life. But this time, it formed into hard, round words. "How can you ask us to go back to our parlors?" I said, rising to my feet. "To turn our backs on ourselves and on our own sex. We don't wish the movement to split. Of course we don't. It saddens me to think of it. But we can do little for the slave as long as we're under the feet of men. Do what you have to do. Censure us, withdraw your support. We'll press on anyway." Now, sirs, kindly take your feet off our necks. That night, I began writing my second pamphlet, Letters on the Equality of the Sexes, working into the hours before dawn. The first line had arranged itself in my head while I'd sat listening to the men try and dissuade us. Whatsoever it is morally right for a man to do, it is morally right for a woman to do. She is clothed by her maker with the same rights, the same duties.
Handful. It was springtime when all the heavy cleaning and airing out was going on in the house, and every night me and Skye would come back to the cellar room after being with the bristle brush all day and fall on the bed. And the first thing I'd see was the quilt frame, the one true roof over my head. I'd think about everything hidden up there. Mama's story quilt, the money, Sarah's booklet, her letter telling me about the promise she'd made to get me free, and I'd fall asleep glad they were safe over my head. Then one Sunday morning, I rolled the frame down. Skye watched me without a word, while I ran my hand over the red quilt with the black triangles, feeling the money sewed inside. I peeled the muslin cloth from round Sarah's booklet and gazed on it, then wrapped it back. Next, I spread the story quilt across the frame and we stood there, looking down at the history of Mama. I laid my palm on the second square. The woman in the field and the slaves flying in the air over her head. all that hope in the wind. We didn't hear Little Missus outside the door. The lock Mama used to have on the door was long gone, and Little Missus, she didn't knock. She flounced on in. I'm going to St. Philip's, and I need my claret cape. You were supposed to mend it for me. Her eyes wandered past me to the quilt frame. What's all this? I stepped to block her view. That's right, I forgot about your cape. I was trying to fan the moth from the flame, but she brushed past me to see the pinks, reds, oranges, purples, and blacks on the quilt. Mama and her colors. I'll be straight over to mend the cape, I said, and took the rope off the hook to hike the frame up before she figured out what she was looking at. She put up her hand. Hold on. You're in an awful big hurry to hide this from me. I fastened the rope back, the high flutter coming in my chest. Sky started humming a thin, nervous tune. I started to put my finger to my lip, but ever since she had that muzzle in her mouth, I couldn't bear to hush her. We looked back and forth to each other while Little Missus squinted from one square to the next like she was reading a book. Everything done to Mama, there it was. The one-legged punishment, the whippings, the branding, the hammering. Mama's body laid on the quilt frame in pieces. The muslin cloth with Sarah's booklet inside was in plain sight, and beside it, the quilt with the money inside. You could see the shape of the bundles laying in the batting. I wanted to tuck everything from view, but I didn't move. When she turned to me, the morning glare fell over her face and the black in her eyes pulled into knots. She said, "Who made this?" "Mama did. Charlotte." "Well, it's gruesome." I never had wanted to scream as bad as I did right then. I said, "Those gruesome things happened to her." A dark pink color poured into her cheeks. "For heaven's sakes, then. You would think her whole life was nothing but violence and cruelty. I mean, it doesn't show what she did to warrant her punishments." She looked at the quilt again, her eyes darting over the appliques. "We treated her well here. No one can dispute that. I can't speak for what happened to her when she ran away. She was out of our care then." Little Missus was rubbing her hands now like she was cleaning them at the washbowl. The quilt had shamed her. She walked to the door and took one look back at it, and I knew she'd never let it stay in the world. She'd send Hector to get it the minute we were out of the room. He'd burn Mama's story to ash. Standing there, waiting for Little Missus' steps to fade, I looked down at the quilt, at the slaves flying in the sky, and I hated being a slave worse than being dead. The hate I felt for it glittered so full of beauty, I sank down on the floor before it. Skye's hair was a bushel basket without her scarf, and when she bent over to see about me, the ends of it poked my face and smelled like the bristle brush. She said, "You all right?" I looked up at her. "We're leaving here." She heard me, but she couldn't be sure. She said, "What you say? We gonna leave here or die trying?" Skye pulled me to my feet like plucking a flower, and I saw Denmark's face settle into hers. That day he rode to his death sitting on a coffin. I'd always wanted freedom, but there never had been a place to go and no way to get there. That didn't matter anymore. I wanted freedom more than the next breath. We'd leave riding on our coffins if we had to. That was the way Mama had lived her whole life. She used to say, "You got to figure out which end of the needle you're gonna be. The one that's fastened to the thread, or the end that pierces the cloth." I lifted the quilt from the frame and folded it up, thinking of the feathers inside, and inside the feathers, the memory of the sky. "Here," I said, laying the quilt in Sky's arms. "I got to go mend that woman's cape. Put the quilt in the gunny sack and take it to Goodis and tell him to hide it with the horse blankets and don't let anybody near it." mending her cape was not all I did. I took little Mrs. Steele's stamp right off her desk while she was standing in the room, and I dropped it in my pocket. I waited till dark to write my letter. 23rd of April, 1838. Dear Sarah, I hope this makes it to you. Me and Sky will be leaving here or die trying. That's how we put it. I don't know how we're doing it, but we've got Mama's money. All we need is a place to come to. I have the address on this letter. I hope I see you again one day. Your friend, Handful.
Sarah. The wedding took place in a house on Spruce Street in Philadelphia on May 14 at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a day full of glinting sunlight and pale blue clouds. It was the sort of day that seemed sharply real and not real at all. I remember standing in the dining room and watching it unfold as if from a distance, as if I was climbing up from the bottom of sleep, coming up from the cool sheets to a new day, one life ending and another beginning. Mother had sent a note of congratulation, which we hadn't expected, begging us to send a letter describing the wedding in detail. "What will Nina wear?" she'd asked. "Oh, that I could see her." Naturally, she'd conveyed how relieved she was that Nina had a husband now, and she hoped we would both retire from the unnatural life we'd been living. But despite that, her letter was plaintive with the love of an aging mother. She called us her dear daughters and lamented the distance between us. "Will I see you again?" she wrote. The question haunted me for days. I gazed at Nina and Theodore standing now before the window about to say their vows. Or as Nina had phrased it, whatever words their hearts gave them at the moment. And I thought it just as well Mother was not here. She would have expected Nina to be in ivory lace, perhaps blue linen, carrying roses or lilies. But Nina had dismissed all of that as unoriginal, and embarked on a wedding designed to shock the masses. She was wearing a brown dress made from free labor cotton, with a broad white sash and white gloves, and she'd matched up Theodore in a brown coat, a white vest, and beige pantaloons. She clutched a handful of white rhododendrons cut fresh from the backyard, and I noticed she'd tucked a sprig in the buttonhole of Theodore's coat. Mother wouldn't have made it past the brown dress, much less the opening prayer, which had been delivered by a Negro minister. When the Philadelphia newspaper announced the wedding, alluding to the mixed-race guests expected to attend, we'd worried there might be demonstrators. Slurs and shouts and rocks whizzing by, but mercifully, no one had showed up but those invited. Sarah Mapps and Grace were here, along with several freed slaves with whom we were acquainted, and we'd timed the wedding to coincide with the anti-slavery convention in the city, so that some of the most prominent abolitionists in the country were in the room, Mr. Garrison, Mr. and Mrs. Garrett Smith, Henry Stanton, the Motts, the Tappins, the Westons, the Chapmans. It would become known as the Abolition Wedding. Nina was speaking now, her face turned up to Theodore's, and I thought suddenly, involuntarily, of Israel, and a tiny grief came over me. Every time it happened, it was like coming upon an empty room I didn't know was there, and stepping in, I would be pierced by it, by the ghost of the one who'd once filled it up. I didn't stumble into this place much anymore, but when I did, it hollowed out little pieces of my chest. Gazing at Nina, radiant Nina, I pictured myself in her place, Israel beside me, the two of us saying vows, and the idea of such a thing cured me. It was the truth I always came back to, that I didn't want Israel anymore. I didn't want to be married now. And yet the phantom of what might have been, the terrible allure of it, could still snatch me. Closing my eyes, I gave my head a shake to clear the remnants of longing away, and when I looked back at the bride and groom, There were dragonflies darting beyond the window. A green tempest, and then it was gone. Nina promised aloud to love and honor him, carefully omitting the word obey, and Theodore launched into an awkward monologue, deploring the laws that gave control of a wife's property to the husband and renouncing all claim to Nina's. And then he coughed self-consciously, as if catching himself, and professed his love. We'd put the confrontation in Mrs. Whittier's cottage behind us. Not that Theodore ever fully conceded his position, but he'd softened his rhetoric after that day, as any man in love would. The abolition movement had split into two camps, just as the man predicted, and Nina and I became even worse pariahs, but it had set the cause of women in motion. I'd been present when Nina opened the letter containing Theodore's proposal. It had come late last winter during a long reprieve in Philadelphia with Sarah Mapps and Grace, as we'd prepared for a series of lectures at the Boston Odeon. Reading it, she'd dropped the pages onto her lap and broken into tears. When she read it to me, I cried too, but my tears were a mix of joy and wretchedness and fear. I wanted this marriage for her. I wanted her happiness as much as my own. But where would I go? For days I couldn't concentrate on the lecture I was trying to write, or hide the bereft feeling I carried inside. I couldn't bear to think of life without her, life alone. But neither did I want to be the burdensome relative living in the back room, getting in the way, and I couldn't imagine Theodore would want me there. Then one day Nina came to me, plopping on the footstool beside my chair in Sarah Mapp's front room. Without a word, she opened her Bible and read aloud the passage in which Ruth speaks to Naomi. "Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people will be my people, and thy God my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." Closing the Bible, she said, "We can't be separated. It isn't possible. You must come and live with me after I'm married. Theodore asked me to tell you that my wish is also his wish." Theodore had bought a small farm in Fort Lee, New Jersey. We would make an odd trinity there, the three of us, but I would still have Nina. We could go on writing and working for abolition and for women, and I would help with the house, and when there were children, I would be auntie. One life ending, another beginning. In the dining room, the minister was offering a prayer, and for some reason I didn't close my eyes as I always did, but watched Nina reach for Theodore's hand. We'd made a plan that I would give the married pair 2 weeks of privacy and then join them in Fort Lee. But I thought now of Mother and the question in her letter. "Will I see you again?" It seemed more than the elegiac pondering in an old woman's heart, and I wondered if I shouldn't seize the break in our work and go to her. "What do you know? We are husband and wife," Nina said when the prayer ended, pronouncing it herself. The dining table sat out in the garden, laid with a white linen cloth, strewn with platters of sweets and fresh-picked flowers, foxglove, pink azalea, and feathery fleabane petals. The confectioner had iced the wedding cake with frothed egg whites and darkened the layers with molasses, in keeping with Nina's brown and white theme. And there was a large bowl of sugared raspberry currant juice, where all of the teetotaler abolitionists were lined up, pretending it hadn't fermented. I'd consumed a sloshing cup of it too quickly, and my head was floating about. I walked among the guests, some 40 or 50 of them, searching for Lucretia, for Sarah Mapps and Grace, thinking, a little tipsily, "Here are our friends, our people, and thank God no one is speaking today about the cruelties in the world." I came upon Mrs. Whittier's son, John, whom I'd not seen since our head-to-head last August. He was amusing everyone with a poem he'd written that skewered Theodore for breaking his vow not to marry. He compared him to the likes of Benedict Arnold. When he saw me, he greeted me like a sister. Lucretia found me before I could find her. It had been years. Beaming, she pulled me to the edge of the garden beside the blooming rhododendron where we could be alone.
"My dear Sarah, I can scarcely believe what you've managed to accomplish."
A blush crept to my face.
"It's true," she said. "You and Angelina are the most famous women in America."
"The most notorious, you mean?" She smiled.
"That too."
I pictured Lucretia and me in her little studio, talking and talking all those evenings. That fretful young woman I'd been, so stalled, so worried she would never find her purpose. I wished I could go back and tell her it would turn out all right. Glancing up, I caught sight of Sarah Mapps and Grace across the garden, striding toward us. Nina and I had traveled almost constantly for the past year and a half, and except for our visit last winter, we'd seen little of them. I wrapped my arms around them, along with Lucretia, who'd known them back at Arch Street. When Sarah Mapps pulled a letter from her purse and handed it to me, I recognized Handful's writing immediately, though it bore my sister Mary's seal. Unable to wait, I ripped it open and read Handful's brief message with a sinking feeling. There were reports of runaways beginning to find their way across the Ohio River from Kentucky, or to Philadelphia and New York from Maryland, but rarely from that far south.
"We're leaving here or die trying."
"What's the matter?" Lucretia said. "You look shaken."
I read them the letter, then folded it back, my hands trembling visibly.
"They'll be caught or killed," I said.
Sarah Mapps frowned.
"They must know what they're attempting. They're not children."
She'd never been to Charleston. She had no idea of the laws and edicts that controlled every moment of a slave's life, of the city guard, the curfew, the passes, the searches, the night watch, the vigilante committees, the slave catchers, the workhouse, the impossibility, the sheer brutality.
"They're coming to us,"
Grace said, as if it had just sunk in.
"And we'll welcome them," Sarah Mapps added. "They can live in your old room in the attic. They can help out at the school."
"They'll never make it this far," I said.
It occurred to me that Handful and Sky might already have left, and I opened up the letter again to look at the date. 23 April.
"It was written only 3 weeks ago,"
I said more to myself than to them.
I doubt they've left by now. There may still be time for me to do something."
"But what could you possibly do?" Lucretia asked.
"I don't know if I can do anything, but I can't sit here on my hands. I'm going back to Charleston. I can at least try and convince my mother to sell them to me so I can set them free."
I'd asked before, but this time I would beg her in person. She had called me her dear daughter.
Handful. Upstairs in the alcove, I peered out the window at the harbor, remembering when I was 10 years old, seeing the water for the first time, how tireless and how far it traveled, making up that little song, prancing round, and now I was coming on 45, and my feet didn't dance anymore. They just wanted to be gone from here. Little Missus hadn't let me out since the whipping, but every free chance I slipped up here. Sometimes, like today, I brought my hand sewing and spent the morning on the window seat with the needle. Little Missus didn't care as long as I did my work, kept my tongue, bobbed my head, said, "Yes'm, yes'm, yes'm." Today was hot, the sun ironed straight in. I opened up the window and the wind blew stiff, dredging up the smell of mudflats. From my perch, I could see the steamboat landing down on East Bay. I'd learned plenty watching the world come and go from that dock. A steamer came most every weekday. I'd watch the snagboat ply ahead of it, clearing the way. Then I'd hear the paddle on the steamer roar and the tugboats huff and the dock slaves holler back and forth, making haste to grab the ropes and put down the plank. When it was time for it to leave again, I'd watch the carriages pull up at the whitewashed building with the steamship company sign, and people would go inside and wait for a spell. Down on the landing, the slaves would unload trunks and goods and bags of mail onto the ship. When 10 o'clock came, the passengers crossed the street and the slaves helped the ladies over the gangplank. The boat never left till the guards showed up. Always two of them, sometimes three, they passed through the ship, first deck, second deck, pilot house, bottom to top. One time they opened every humpback trunk before it went on board. That's when I knew they were searching for stowaways, for slaves. The Thursday boat went all the way to New York, and then you got on another one going to Philadelphia. I'd learned that from reading the Charleston Post and Courier, which I'd swiped from the drawing room. It printed all the schedules, said the tickets cost $55. Today, the steamboat landing was empty, but I wasn't up here in the alcove to watch the boat. I was up here to figure a way to get on it. All these weeks, I'd been patient, careful. Yes'm, yes'm. Now I sat here with the palmettos clacking in the wind and thought of the girl who bathed in a copper tub. I thought of the woman who stole a bullet mold. I loved that girl, that woman. I went over everything I'd seen out there on the harbor, everything I knew. I sat with my hands still, my eyes closed, my mind flying with the gulls, the world tilting like a bird wing. When I stood up, every one of my limbs was shaking. The next week, when Hector was handing out duties for the day, he told Minta, "Go strip the bedding in the house and take it to the laundry house." I thought quick and said, "Oh, I'll do that. Poor Minta's back is hurting her." She looked at me curious, but didn't argue. "You take a rest whatever way you can get it." In the alcove that day, a picture had sprung in my head. Dresses. I saw the black dresses the missuses had worn to mourn their husbands. I saw their spoon bonnets with the thick black veils and their black gloves. These things came to me clear as the bright of day. When I got to Mrs. Rome, I tugged off the bed linens, listening for footsteps on the stairs, for a cane poking its way, then I opened the last drawer of her linen press. I'd folded away Mrs. Morning dress, her bonnet and gloves, my own self all those years back. I'd packed them in linen with camphor gum to keep out the moth eggs and laid them in the bottom drawer. Reaching back there, I worried they were long gone, that what warded off the moths had drawn the rats, but then my fingers brushed against the linen. I peeked inside the parcel. It was still the grandest dress I'd ever made. Black velvet stitched with hundreds of black glass beads. Some of them had come loose and were scatter-rolling in the linen folds. The veil on the bonnet had two spider tears that would have to be fixed. Plus, I'd forgot the gloves were fingerless mitts. I'd have to sew fingers on them. I whisked everything into the bed sheets, bundled it up, and tied a top knot. Leaving it outside the door, I hurried into little Miss's room. Her funeral outfit was stored nearly the same way in her bureau, but with cedar chips instead of camphor. I didn't know how we'd air out all these rowdy smells. When I got her dress, hat, and gloves rolled tight in the sheets, I threw both of the bed bundles over my back and went down the stairs with my cane straight to the cellar room. That night after me and Sky had dragged the bed over to block the door, she tried on Mrs. Black Velvet dress and stood there with the buttons undone. Thick waist as Mrs. was, I'd still have to let the bodice out for Sky. Add 6 inches to the length and 2 to the sleeves. She was her daddy's girl, all right. Little Mrs. was normal size, but there was enough room inside her dress for 2 of me. The only thing we didn't have was shoes, proper shoes. What we had was slave shoes, and that would have to do. I started to work that night. Sky fetched threads and shears for me and watched every stitch. She sang the Gullah song she liked best. If you don't know where you're going, you should know where you come from. I told her, we know where we're going now. Yeah, she said. We'll be ready when the steamer leaves Thursday, 8 days from now. She picked up her apron draped on the rocker and dug in the pocket, pulling out 2 little bottles, like the kind Aunt Sister used for tinctures. I boiled us some white oleander tea. A quiver ran from my neck to my fingers. White oleander was the most deadly plant in the world. A bush had caught fire on Hassel Street, and a man dropped dead just breathing the smoke. The brown liquid in Sky's bottle would curl us on the floor, retching to the last breath. But it wouldn't take long. We leaving or die trying, Sky said.
Sarah. I arrived in Charleston during a thunderstorm. As the steamer groaned into the harbor, lightning tore rifts in the sky and rain pelted sideways. And still, I stepped out beneath the roof of the upper deck so I could watch the city come into view. I hadn't seen it in 16 years. We turned past Fort Sumter at the harbor's mouth, which didn't look much further along in its construction than when I'd sailed away. The peninsula loomed up like an old mirage rising from the water, the white houses on the Battery blurred in the gray rain. For a moment, I felt the quiet, hungering thing that comes inside when you return to the place of your origins, and then the ache of misbelonging. It was beautiful, this place, and it was savage. It swallowed you and made you a part of itself, or if you proved too inassimilable, it spit you out like the pit of a plum. I'd left here of my own will, and yet it seemed the city had banished me in much the same way I'd banished it. Seeing it now after so long, seeing the marsh grass pitching wildly around the edges of the city, the rooftops hunkered together with their ship watches and widow walks, and behind them the steeples of St. Philip's and St. Michael's lifted like dark fingers, I was not sorry for loving Charleston or for leaving it. Geography had made me who I was. Wind swept my bonnet off the back of my head, the sash catching at my neck, and turning to grab it, I saw the menacing couple through the window of the salon. Traveling home after socializing in Newport, they'd recognized me shortly after we'd left New York. I'd tried to keep aloof from everyone, but the woman had stared at me with unrelenting curiosity.
"You're the Grimke daughter, aren't you?" she said. "The one who..."
Her husband took her arm and steered her away before she could finish. She'd meant to say, "the one who betrayed us." They glared at me now, at my wet skirt and fluttering bonnet, and I felt certain the man would report my arrival to the authorities as soon as we landed. Perhaps returning had been a terrible mistake after all. I moved away from them to the bow of the boat as a crack of thunder broke overhead, becoming lost in the noise of the engine. Charleston would forgive its own many things, but not betrayal. I found Handful within an hour of my arrival. She was sewing in the upstairs alcove, of all places. When she saw me standing there, she leapt up, stumbling a little with her infirm leg, dropping the slave shirt on the floor along with the needle and thread. I reached to catch her as she righted herself and found myself embracing her, feeling her embrace me back. "I got your letter," I told her, softly, in case there were listening ears somewhere.
She shook her head. But you didn't come back 'cause of that. 'Cause of me.
Of course I did, I said. I picked up the shirt and we sat down on the cushioned window seat. She was wearing her customary red scarf and seemed barely changed. Her eyes were still large as bowls, the golden color darkened somewhat, and she was tiny as ever, not frail or insubstantial, but distilled, concentrated. There was a cane propped between us, with a fanciful carving of a rabbit on the handle. Moving it to the side, she said,
You didn't come to try and stop us, did you?
It's dangerous, Handful. I'm afraid for you.
Well, that may be, but I'm more scared of bowing and scraping to your mama and your sister the rest of my days.
Speaking barely above a whisper, I told her about my plan to try and convince Mother to sell the two of them to me. She laughed a bitter sound.
Uh-huh.
I hadn't expected that. I looked past her, scanning the harbor, noticing the steamer in the distance rinsed clean by the rain. She shifted herself on the cushion and I heard the breath leave her.
I just don't see Mrs. doing one thing favorable for me, that's all. But here you are, all this way. Nobody else would have done that for me. So it's worth a try. And if she's willing to sell us, I'll pay you back everything I got. $400.
There would be no need
where I ain't doing it any other way.
We stopped talking as Hector, the butler Mary had installed, came up the stairs with my trunk, his gaze lingering longer than was comfortable. I stood.
I should get settled. You go on and talk to her then,
Handful whispered.
But don't be waiting too long.
I waited 4 days. It seemed imprudent to make the request before that. I wanted Mother to believe I'd return solely to see her. I broached the matter on Tuesday afternoon while we sat in the drawing room, Mother, Mary, and I, swishing our fans at the vaporous heat. A languid silence had fallen that none of us seemed willing to break. We'd exhausted all the harmless subjects, the rainy weather, the spectacular wonder of the railroad that ran from Charleston to Savannah, an expurgated version of Nina's wedding, news of my siblings, the nieces and nephews I'd never met. If I had any chance at securing freedom for Handful and Sky, we couldn't speak of my scandalous adventures, which had been in all the papers, nor of abolition, slavery, the North, the South, religion, politics, or the fact that I'd been outlawed in the city the previous summer.
People are talking, Sarah, Mary said, breaking the lull.
She exchanged a look with Mother, and I glimpsed how in step they were with one another, how alike. An echo of loneliness reverberated from my girlhood, and I felt again like the odd child out. Even now. I heard Binna's voice somewhere in my memory.
Poor Miss Sarah.
These irrational, childish feelings. Where had they come from, suddenly?
Rumors are running rampant that you've returned, Mary was saying. It's only a matter of time before the sheriff arrives to inquire about it. And if you're here, I'm not sure what you expect us to say. We can hardly hide you like a fugitive.
I turned to Mother, watching her eyes veer away toward the piazza. The windows were open, and the chocolatey smell of the oleander streamed in, sickeningly thick.
You wish me to leave?
It's not a matter of what we wish, Mother said. If the authorities come, I wouldn't give you over to them. Of course not. You're my daughter.
You're still a Grimke. We only suggest it would be easier all around if you cut your visit short.
To my surprise, her eyes filled. She was plump now, with thinned white hair and one of those ancient faces that's deeply cobblestoned. She peered at me as the tears started to spill, and I left my chair and went to her. Bending down awkwardly, I put my arms around her. She clung to me an instant, then straightened. Instead of returning to my seat, I paced toward the window and back, gathering my bravery. I won't put you at risk. I'll leave on the next steamer, but before I go, I have a request. I would like to purchase Hetty and her sister, Skye.
Purchase them? Mary said. But why? You hardly barter in slaves.
Mary, for heaven's sake, she means to free them, Mother said.
I'll offer you any amount.
I walked to Mother's side. Please, I would consider it a great kindness to me. Mary rose and came to the other side of Mother's chair.
We can't possibly do without Hetty, she said. There are few seamstresses in Charleston to match her. She's irreplaceable. The other one is expendable, but not Hetty.
Mother stared at her hands. Her shoulders moved up and down with her breath, and I began to feel a prick of hope.
There are laws that make it difficult, she said. Emancipating them would require a special act of the legislature.
Difficult, but it could be done, I responded. Something inside of her seemed to bend, to arch toward me. Mary sensed it too. She placed her hand on our mother's, linking the two of them. She said,
We can't do without Hetty, and we must think of her as well. Where will she go? Who will take care of her? She has a home here.
This is not her home. It's her prison, I said. Mary stiffened.
We don't need you to come here and lecture us about slavery. I won't stand here and defend it to you. It's our way of life.
Her words infuriated me. I wondered for a moment if holding my tongue would help my cause with Mother. Was it ever right to sacrifice one's truth for expedience? Mother would do what she would do, wouldn't she? I wondered how it was possible I'd found my words out there in the world, but could lose them in the house where I was born. It gave way inside of me. Years of being here, coexisting with the untenable.
Your way of life? What does that justify? Slavery is a hell-concocted system. It cannot be defended.
Small red wafers splotched along Mary's neck.
God has ordained that we take care of them, she said, flustered now, spluttering.
I took a step toward her, my outrage breaking open.
You speak as if God was white and southern, as if we somehow owned his image. You speak like a fool. The Negro is not some other kind of creature than we are. Whiteness is not sacred, Mary. It can't go on defining everything.
I doubt anyone had ever spoken to her in such a manner, and she turned away from me, taken aback. I couldn't explain that rising up, this coming fully to myself, the audacity and authority my life had found. It took me aback as well, and I closed my eyes, and I blessed it. It was like arriving finally in the place I'd left, and I felt then I would never be in exile again. Mother lifted her hand.
This has tired me, she said, and struggled to her feet with her old gold-tipped cane.
She walked to the door, then turned back, leveling her eyes on mine.
I won't sell Hetty or Skye to you, Sarah. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I will compromise.
In the darkness of the cellar, the sound of my knocking seemed lost and swallowed up. It was past midnight. I'd waited until now to find Handful, slipping down here when the house was asleep, still wearing my sleeping clothes. The lantern swayed in my hand, swiveling the shadows, as I rapped again on Handful's door.
Come on, Handful. Wake up. Who's out there?
Her voice sounded alarmed and muffled behind the door.
It's all right. It's me, Sarah.
She made a slit in the door, then let me inside. She held a candle that flickered beneath her chin. Her eyes appeared almost luminous.
I'm sorry to wake you, but we must talk.
Across the room, Sky was sitting up in her bed, her hair splayed out like a great dark fan.